Welcome, everyone. We have a full house today and a very large agenda. So we will start today by opening a work session on Senate Bill 844. Senator Decker.
Thank you, Ann. We are going to be done in 10 minutes because you have a very busy
schedule.
Because you have a very busy schedule and a lot of folks. Thank you for coming back to us. The reason, Madam Chair, I introduced this bill, and if I could let Ms. Immel talk for a second, she is one of those folks that meets the standard that I said in the first testimony of a true hero. A little boy.
Please, could you identify yourself before you continue?
Yes, Madam Chair, I apologize. A little boy in Aloha.
Still identifying yourself for the record.
I'm that little boy.
I give up.
And I live near Aloha. I am Ryan Deckert. I am a state senator from Beaverton, and I represent Beaverton and Aloha in Southwest Portland, and thank you for having me identify myself. Madam Chair, and seated to my right is Kathleen Immel, and she watched a little boy near death. She was driving by and saw a child near his death, and what she did, and she can talk a little bit about it, but she saved the 7-year-old's life. She went and laid on top of him and saved his life. And so if Ms. Immel could just talk to you briefly, I will give you the product of our work group, but I'd like to hand it over to Ms. Immel for just a minute or two to recognize her valiancy and the product of this work group is her heroism.
Thank you very much. And boy, you're the type of person we sure don't want to cut short around here, and I'm just so pleased to meet you. I certainly followed your heroism in the paper. So welcome to the committee, and would you please identify yourself?
I'm Kathleen Immel, and I live in Hillsboro, work in Aloha, and the day that the incident occurred, I wasn't afraid of dogs in the least. I really am a dog lover, and I care about people too. I am here today because I want to support the bill that's being presented, and I would love to see it passed. For me, it would be part of my healing process, and for Joshua, the little boy who's really dealing with some very serious emotional issues, especially right now, I just think that we owe it to all of our community to take responsibility for those who don't take it, and see that something's done. And I think the bill, the way that I've seen it redone and the way that it's written now, certainly would do that. It would put responsibility where it needs to be.
Thank you very much, and thank you for coming. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
I'm Officer Rowiter from Washington County Animal Services. I'm the one that dealt with the dogs that attacked Kathleen, and we deal with pit bull and pit bull mixes greatly in Washington County. I support the bill the way it's rewritten now.
Thank you.
And it needs to be looked at very closely because they can be a very, very dangerous animal.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. Senator Deckert, did you want to very briefly describe the amendments?
I will. I will go through them briefly because they are a consensus work group. And Ms. Immel, just so we get it straight, because she's being very modest, but her story of laying on and driving past, and she won't tell you, so I should. We all hope we would actually rise to that level of seeing a little boy in danger and laying on top of him and taking the wounds for that little boy. And so that was the impetus behind this bill. After your first hearing, Madam Chair, what we did is we convened at your request a work group to get all the parties involved that had an interest in this issue, and you see them before you, comprised of animal control agencies, Clackamas County Commissioner Larry Sowa, who represented the veterinarian point of view, Patty Strand, who represented the American Kennel Club. And what you see before you is the product of that work group. Here's what it does. It removes all mention of a breeder registry because that was a concern to the committee. Deals with the first dog bite offense penalty for dog keeper remaining how it is under current law, and it deals with the issue of repeat offense, which is outlined in Senate Bill 844. It establishes a potentially dangerous dog and dangerous dog classification based upon a dog's actions. The definition of that is chasing and menacing, causing an injury to a person that is less severe than a serious injury. The dangerous dog has killed or caused injury attacking a domestic animal off the property of the owner and is running at large or impounded on owners cited by the animal control authority. A dangerous dog is the following. It inflicts serious injury on or kills a human being, is previously determined to be and currently listed as a potentially dangerous dog whose owner is not in compliance, and has been used as a weapon in the commission of a crime. If it is determined that an owner has a potentially dangerous dog after it is adjudicated, all potentially dangerous dogs shall be properly licensed, vaccinated against rabies, photographed, and microchipped, owned by adult, defined by law, and spayed or neutered. While on the owner's property, they shall be at times kept indoors or in proper enclosure on the facility. Obviously, that is added to protect the neighbors in a residential environment. The other only area that I would highlight for you, Madam Chair, on this is the judicial process. The determination of a potentially dangerous or dangerous dog, if an animal control officer or law enforcement officer has investigated and determined that there exists probable cause to believe that a dog is potentially dangerous or dangerous, the chief officer of the public pound or animal control department or the head of local law enforcement agency shall petition the municipal court within the judicial district wherein the dog is owned and kept for a hearing. And it deals with the statewide registry, which the authority has, Multnomah County authority stepped up and said they'd like to have a website that would list some of these very, very dangerous dogs so that citizens would have the ability to quickly find out if they are dealing with an animal that has shown a propensity to be very, very dangerous dog. And it gets at that whole issue of a statewide registry. So, Madam Chair, hopefully we've kept it within 10 minutes. This is, like I said, a product of a consensus work group that sat in a room, and Susie Funkenhauser deserves the credit for this, gathering the group together, getting the parties, and coming up with those amendments that really reflected the overall consensus of all interested parties in this issue.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your ongoing work on these issues. And again, we are very privileged and happy to see you here today, especially seeing you in such good health after all you've been through. So thank you very much. We'll close. We have a technical problem with the amendment. I appreciate the consensus group that you formed, but we will bring that back after we resolve the technical glitch and hopefully move that out very soon. So thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 844. We will open now a public hearing on Senate Bill 304. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 304 would revive product liability civil actions for damages that resulted from asbestos-related disease claims. The measure would permit the commencements of such actions that were otherwise barred by the expiration of the statute of limitations if those actions were filed before January 1, 2008. The measure does not apply to any claims for which a judgment had already been entered, at least before January 1, 2006. Would not apply to any cases in which all of the appeals have been exhausted unless the judgment was based on the expiration of the statute of limitations. And the measure is also inapplicable to any claim that was resolved by a written settlement entered into before January 1, 2006, so long as the plaintiff in that case was represented by an attorney admitted to practice in Oregon.
Thank you very much, and I want to welcome all the people in this audience who came on this bill from points far away. I understand there was a bus that came on this bill, so I want to welcome you to Salem, and I'm glad you could make it. We will call for our first witnesses, Ron Murray and Ann Samuelson. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Murray. I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steamfitters of the United States and Canada, Local 290. And we are here to support or ask for your support for Senate Bill 304. We would like to introduce the members of Local 290. We have approximately 50 members that did come down today to support this bill. And this is 50 members out of approximately 4,500 members that Local 290 has in the state of Oregon, Southwest Washington, and Northern California. I have personally received my asbestos abatement specialist license from the state of Oregon, and am also a trained medical professional as a fire medic in the state of Oregon. And I can tell you that asbestos and asbestosis and the related diseases that asbestos causes, not simply to the individual that was contaminated by asbestos or was exposed to it on a job site, but also to the family members, the spouses and the children, because the asbestos was carried home in the workers' clothes, and when the clothes were put in the wash machine and the dust flew out through the house, we are finding incidents of asbestosis not simply years but decades after the original exposure. And so many times, although the worker may now be deceased, the family is still suffering from the effects of the asbestos. In a more ironic twist of fate, where a spouse or a family member would die, and then the individual that worked either in the shipyards or on pipe or on boilers where they were using this insulation material would actually survive the spouse or family member. We do believe that it is fair to the workers of the state of Oregon to repeal the statute of limitations on the asbestos and the asbestos claims, and we hope that you will agree with us. Mrs. Samuelson has taken this to task, and I'm sure she can fill you in on some more details. We also have members of Local 290, Madam Chair, if you wish to hear their personal stories as well.
Thank you. And again, I want to welcome all the members of Local 290 who took the time out of their day to come and be in Salem today. I really appreciate you being here. Ms. Samuelson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. I appreciate you taking the time to hear this. This has been a...
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Ann Samuelson. Do you want our address, too? Just Ann Samuelson. I am a plumbing contractor in Astoria, Oregon, and run my dad's business. He died of mesothelioma 22 years ago. And that's what this is really all about for me. And the support's incredible. I mean, I can't think of a better group of guys to have behind me than these guys. The brief version of this is that I asked questions for years. My mother did get a state accident settlement monthly check that wouldn't even cover close to what her pension would have been. He died at the age of 53 of meso, and was exposed probably 20 years heavily before, and then I was also exposed because he would come home with it on him. The reason it's taken me so long to get it together to get here to talk to you about this is I think we don't want to deal with our own mortality, and when my youngest one turned 18, it was time. It was time to open the box. So I opened the box, and what I found was the legislature had done a lot of work on asbestos reform already. And so I enlisted the help of Stephen Kazin, who's probably one of the number one asbestos litigators in the country. Out of Oakland, California, he testifies before the U.S. Senate. And he's been incredibly helpful to me. I actually flew down to meet him, and he's just helped me, and we've become good friends. And he said where the hole is in this, that they sort of forgot about the people before 1983. And my dad died in 1982. So there are bankruptcy trusts. It's not like I'm writing this bill so that everybody can run out and sue a bunch of contractors. That's not what this is about. There are bankruptcy trusts that were set up to somehow take the burden financially off of people such as my mother. And she can't access those with the laws the way they are now. And at the time when the statute of repose was in effect, all we ever heard from attorneys in our area was, well, everybody's declaring bankruptcy. There's nothing you can do. So it would help her to be able to access those. I think there's about 30 or 40 of these trusts already set up. The money's already there. Johns Manville, there's all these companies that have already done that. So that's what I look for her. But more importantly than that, I'm just here to say that we can't forget. And we can't continue to, you know, when I hear about nationally that they're going to decide that if you die of this, you're worth this much money. I'd like to know that in Oregon we don't act like that, that we care and we think that people shouldn't die of how they make a living. Shouldn't happen. So I'd appreciate your support. If we could get this to a work session, that'd be just super. I've been working on this for about 2 years. I've given you each a packet, tried to keep it as concise as I could with some history about the statute of repose and compared it to New York. I'm not doing what New York did. New York opened up all tort, which then flooded their court system. This is asbestos only. And this is only my first step, by the way. I'm hoping that we can heighten awareness about asbestos because it's still out there. We just ran into it on a job the other day. Yesterday, as a matter of fact. So this is a baby step for me. It's kind of my cause. So I sure appreciate getting this further if we could, and whatever we need to do that, I'm doing it.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming today. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Next,
thank
we
you.
Have Gail Bast and Frank Dinker from Local 290.
The official delegates
of the group, huh? Did you draw the short straw or the long straw? Welcome to the committee. Thank you.
My name is Gail Bast, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I've been a member of Local 290 for 39 years, and I started out working for contractors that we just went into places and we took hammers and we just beat this asbestos to pieces and get the pipe. And so we've been exposed. I've been tested and I've been diagnosed with asbestosis. I don't know to what extent, but they tell me that I've got it. And I don't have any effects from it, but someday I may. And this would be something that would be, my wife and family would be able to benefit from it.
Thank you. Well, it's good to have you here, and you look very healthy now, so that's great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Frank Vinker. I'm a 32-year member of Local 290, retired. And it seems like I was around asbestos half my life. Even prior to getting into the fitters, I worked for the W.R. Grace Company, which is now totally out of business because of asbestos. And I used to put bales of asbestos in a machine to make monocoat. We never wore a face mask or anything. Back in the 60s, that wasn't heard of. And then got into the pipe fitters and worked at Penwalt Chemical Plant for 8 years. And same as Gail, you beat it off with a hammer. That's the way you exposed a piece of pipe. So, and I don't know that I have asbestosis. They've never said I did. It always seems kind of vague, you know, asbestosis and all that. They say I have asbestos. It's gone through my lungs. It's now on the outside. It's burrows its way through. And I have very much so reduced lung capacity. I don't do good on those tests. So do I have upcoming problems? I don't know. But I definitely have reduced lung capacity. That's all I know. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. I'm going to limit testimony today to members of Local 290. Is there anyone else from that local who would like to come up and talk before we close this hearing? Again, thank you so much for coming, and I invite you all to stay for the rest of the meeting. We have a variety of issues up here today, and would invite you to stay and watch for as long as you can take it. Thank you. We will now close the hearing on Senate Bill 304, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 220. Just a moment while we change the guard here. Okay, council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 220 would authorize the State Board of Higher Education, the Oregon University System, and the presidents of state institutions of higher education to employ attorneys outside the Department of Justice. It also exempts interstate and international agreements by the Oregon University System from review by the Attorney General for legal sufficiency, which would otherwise be required. There are two proposed amendments in your packets. There's a dash 3 amendment that would add a section that prohibits the board, chancellor, or president from retaining attorneys who are not employed by the Oregon University System or the Department of Justice for purposes of representing the system in a collective bargaining, administrative hearing, or arbitration, or in litigation related to collective bargaining. There is also a proposed dash 4 amendment that would add language stating that privately retained attorneys under this section may not appear in any court or commence any action of any kind in any court on behalf of the state without the prior written approval of the Attorney General.
Thank you. And we have in the front row, decked out in their beaver ties, Neil Bryant and George Pernsteiner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. For the record, George Pernsteiner, Acting Chancellor, Oregon University System. Most of you know me and know that I have worn yellow and green and white and green all of my adult life. This is my first opportunity to have orange and black. It feels good, but it does feel a little bit strange.
Madam Chair,
Senator Walker,
I noticed that the Chancellor's not actually wearing the tie. He's just draping it.
He's trying to get the best of all worlds, I think, Senator Walker.
He's making progress. I haven't even put mine on.
I want to see that green and white handkerchief come out here. Anyway, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Again, for the record, George Pernsteiner, it's my privilege this afternoon to introduce Senate Bill 220, which is a proposal for a limited ability of the Oregon University System to retain attorneys on our staff to address our daily needs. We've been served for many years by the State Attorney General. The Oregon University System is about 75 years old, and throughout that entire period, the State Attorney General and his staff has provided some very fine service, and we appreciate that. However, we believe the time has come for a somewhat different relationship between the university system and the Attorney General. I'm joined this afternoon, and you will hear from Neil Bryant, who is on my right, who is a consultant to the university system, by Ed Ray, the president of Oregon State University, and by Dave Frommeyer, the president of the University of Oregon. You have also before you, I believe, a letter from Dan Bernstein, the president of Portland State University, all of which is supportive of the bill. And they will speak very eloquently about their campus needs and why, after all this time, it may be time to reflect upon and change a bit the arrangement which we have had. Senate Bill 220 will save us money. Senate Bill 220 will lead to improved service
and quicker response.
And Senate Bill 220 will lead to the inclusion of legal advice in the decision-making framework that presidents use. It focuses on client service within the framework of national and state laws, rules, and regulations, and court cases. It will not lead to OUS attorneys opposing AG attorneys in court. And that's even clearer, I think, with the Dash 4 amendments. Nor will it prevent OUS from using DOJ and its attorneys in those areas where those attorneys have particular expertise. Senate Bill 220 is aimed at improving timeliness and service to campuses and at saving money. This year, we expect to spend about $1.5 million on legal representation. Our budget is a smidge over $600,000. We believe that this passage of Senate Bill 220 will, over time, permit us to save a substantial portion of that $1.5 million that we spend each year. Senate Bill 220 will help our campuses avoid paying for double and triple review of contracts, which is a practice that has become common in the Department of Justice as attorneys find their assignments shifting from agency to agency and from section within DOJ to section within DOJ. Senate Bill 220 will help prevent situations such as one at one of the universities in which the university elected not to go with a particular firm whom they had selected as architect because that firm was too expensive. The DOJ attorney, nonetheless, concluded the agreement, and the university felt forced to accept that and to pay that extra money. In cases where, in fact, the attorney is within that university, we do not believe that that could occur. Mostly, though, Senate Bill 220 will improve client service, focusing on meeting the legitimate education, research, and service needs of the universities rather than on the way things have always been done in state agencies. Those of you who know me know that I have been in universities or public agencies for almost 40 years. I shudder to think about that, actually. In that time, I've been represented by a host of attorneys, elected attorneys, appointed attorneys, retained attorneys. I've been subject to a barrage of legal advice over that period of time, and I've been represented in court actions that have had to be ultimately signed off on by justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. I've had a lot of experience with attorneys in my role as a client. And I have to say that in that time, the important distinction, and I've been served well by them, I want to say that, an important distinction, however, exists. And that is, what is the focus of the legal representation? Is it on helping the client achieve what the client needs to achieve in order to meet the client's mission? In our case, education, research, and service. And in our case, too, a changed environment financially that has caused us to do contracts and other things that are beyond the scope of what we did 20 or 30 years ago. Is it to help the client within a legal framework properly do its business, or is it to try to fit the template of a state agency because that's the way state agencies have to do business? The question of client service, the question of who does the attorney represent, is a very important one, and I think it is at the heart of the reason that we are requesting your approval of Senate Bill 220 and its Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments. Thank you.
What is it about your situation that would be different from, say, any state agency? I mean, why wouldn't all state agencies want to have the same basis?
Chair Burdick, I can't speak for the other state agencies. What I can say is that in our particular situation, the ability to have counsel at the campuses dealing with the issues with the presidents and the executive team is critical to being able to make appropriate decisions, make them in a timely way, and execute contracts appropriately. I worry, too, about the timeliness and double and triple review and therefore conflicting advice that often occurs on some of the contracts within which we have tried to execute. And I don't know if other state agencies have that same situation or not, but I'm saying that for the day-to-day needs of our campuses, it is very, very desirable, if not imperative, that we have attorneys available to the campuses. We are like small cities on the campuses. We have thousands of people every day on every one of the campuses. We have all of the issues that you would have with respect to running a city. Because we have people living there. We operate in that entire panoply of work that needs to be done. And it is very, very helpful within the legal framework which we have, which by federal law and state laws is somewhat different than some other agencies have, to be able to have someone who understands that environment and can help us better manage and properly manage the campuses.
Well, the way the bill is written now, it's almost as if you were to have your own law firm and just be completely independent. Is that what you're after?
Well, Chair Burdick, in fact, I don't believe the bill actually makes it our own law firm. What the bill does allow, I mean, the bill says, and the Dash 4 amendments clarify, that in fact, in many cases, we will use the Attorney General. We will use the Attorney General for all trial work, unless the Attorney General says differently. We will use the Attorney General for all appellate work. We will use the Attorney General in those arenas in which the Attorney General's staff have particular expertise. The Attorney General also will be taking a look, obviously, at our entire efforts. And I do not believe that we have that we will create law firms. The other thing is, we're trying in part in this to save money. It is not in our interest to hire more attorneys than we need to do the business at hand. We know that with all of the issues that happen at Oregon State and at Portland State, that in fact those campuses need attorneys. We also understand that with regard to the regional campuses and the chancellor's office, we need advice as well. However, it is highly unlikely that there will be very many attorneys hired at any of the campuses, because you have to make a business case and a financial case in order to do it.
Okay, well, maybe we'll, are there questions? Maybe we should hold the further questions from mainly the chair until we hear from Mr. Bryan. Welcome.
Thank you.
Feel on that end of the podium there.
It's is both reassuring in some respects, because I know I get to go home to Bend, but I, at other times it'd be wonderful to have that gavel again.
Well, aren't you glad you trained me to be respectful of witnesses?
I am. I am.
And you still have to identify yourself for the record.
I shall. Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Neil Bryant, and I'm an attorney from Bend, Oregon. I practiced law for 32 years, and I mention that because this is about lawyers and clients, and I've represented people in the private sector primarily, but we also represent school districts, park districts. I have never represented, I don't believe, a state agency, but of course was involved with the Attorney General's office many times. And last year I was hired as a consultant for Oregon State, and that's why I'm here today. 16 months ago we had a real change in the Board of Higher Education, and they're a focus group with a vision and a purpose to provide access and affordability in education, retain and improve the quality of instruction, develop programs to accelerate economic development, and then educate more Oregonians. And this is bill is consistent with that, as the Chancellor has mentioned. In 2005, the State Board only had two substantive policy packages, and one is Senate Bill 220. And this was approved and moved forward by the Board when the Governor was the chair. And I mention that because, obviously, the Governor knows about the bill and is supportive with the amendments. In 2003, there was a Senate Bill 437, and I know Senator Starr is familiar with this because it was in front of the Education Committee. And at that time, there was similar language related to attorney's fees that did not pass in the final bill, because the committee wanted and the governor wanted the attorney general and the system to work out an intergovernmental agreement. That was done. From U.S. perspective, that agreement has not been as successful as it needs to be, for the reasons that were stated by the Chancellor and will be confirmed by the Presidents. Consequently, no new SAGs have been appointed. There are three presently. Those are special attorney generals that serve at Oregon, Oregon State, and then one at the Chancellor's office. You ask about a law firm. The plan for the next 2 years is to have a total of seven, two at Portland State, two at Oregon, two at Oregon State, and the remaining one would be at the Chancellor's office. We think that for the next 2 years could satisfy most of our legal needs as far as the day-to-day type transactions that occur on campus. And if you ask me for something that's similar in the private world, I'd say this is like an in-house counsel or in-house counsel type situations, where the president or the chancellor and the attorneys don't feel comfortable in getting certain advice because it's beyond their expertise, they would have the discretion to hire then someone to do this work. And that could be the Department of Justice. In fact, they would be required to use them for trial work, which is fine. They've provided a good service in that area. And they would use it for their preference would be on contract work and construction, because they've got expertise and are very good in that area. But the big shift in this bill and the change in direction is the discretion as to who to hire and what who to fire and what the work assignments would be would shift to the campuses and the chancellor's office. And the presidents and the chancellor would make the decision of who to hire and what those work assignments would be, rather than the Department of Justice. The Attorney General, and by the way, we've met several times,
We've had negotiations and proposals and counter-proposals. They've been cordial and professional, and we've made progress. But we have an impasse that we can't overcome, and that's why you have this particular bill. As long as we're subject to Chapter 180, the Attorney General does not feel comfortable in allowing discretion on hiring and firing work assignments to rest solely at the campus or with the Chancellor's office. This will relieve him of that responsibility so he wouldn't have that worry. That's one of the main issues. The second main issue that has been alluded to by the Chancellor is what the SAGs can do on campus. And this is a dispute dealing with a term called legal sufficiency review. And if you look at the LFO report, you'll see that causes quite a bit in the way of fees for the university system. We feel that the campus should have more discretion in what those SAGs can do in the way of legal sufficiency review, and this bill would allow them to do that. The two amendments, -3 and -4, would give assurances to the committee that in litigation and appellate work and collective bargaining litigation, that it would be the Department of Justice or someone else, only with the Attorney General's approval, that would proceed in that. So that's the purposes of those two amendments. You'll have a letter in front of you from President Bernstein. He would be here today, but he has jury duty. And he didn't think it'd be a good example if he asked to be excused again. And with that, you asked a question, Madam Chair, I'd like to respond to. Why is the Oregon University system different from other state agencies? I think it is different. And it's the university system. It's not like a regular state agency in many respects. It relies on tuition and fees, on government grants, on a variety of things for its funding sources. It has an individual culture on each campus, and then collectively that you need to be there on a daily basis to have a good understanding of it. I believe that 35 other states allow their university systems to have their own council, and Oregon is one of the more restrictive states in that regard. So with that, I would stop my testimony and invite President Ray and President Bernstein, President Frommeyer to be here, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We will be. I wanted to, what kind of, you said that you would use the Attorney General for some of the trial work and the appellate work and that sort of thing, but what relationship, if any, would these in-house people have with the Attorney General?
Well, they have a relationship with them now as far as being SAGs for 18 or 19 years. That's Melinda Greer and Carolyn Curl. So they've got a relationship with the people that they deal with now and know what their expertise is. And no one here is encouraging people to give bad legal advice. That's not what's going to happen.
What kind of institutional relationship, if any, would there be with the Attorney General? Would these be completely employees of the university?
Yes.
And in your negotiations, and we will have the Attorney General coming up in a few minutes, but in your negotiations with the Attorney General, did you find that it would be possible to have some kind of relationship with the Attorney General's office and still accomplish your objectives?
Yes, with what we're proposing in the amendments, with the agreement proposed, the last agreement proposed by the Department of Justice, we still have the two issues that I outlined that caused the impasse. And so I think the Attorney General's position, I don't mean to speak for him, but I will, because he can correct me if I'm wrong, is that as long as the SAGs are under 180, he has to retain that responsibility. I'm not sure I answered your question.
So you're not opposed to having some institutional relationship with the Attorney General's office. It's just a matter of how that is construed that you're arguing over.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Buttigieg, Mr. Brandt, and pursuant to our conversation this morning, the Climas School District was alleged to have misused public funds by district patrons. In response, the district hired a private lawyer who in turn hired a private investigator and an accountant to investigate that situation. The accountant and the private investigator then reported to the lawyer, who then reported back to the district with his findings. The district reported no wrongdoing to the public. When the public asked for the district to produce the study, the district claimed lawyer-client privilege and refused the request. And the district attorney, also a district attorney request in a subpoena, the district court in litigation found in favor of the district upholding the lawyer-client privilege. The case is currently under appeal. So my question to you, Mr. Bryant, is how would the public right to know be protected in the situation where the lawyer, where the university hire their own private lawyer?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the law you're discussing is called the Public Records Act, and apparently the school district asserted an exemption under that act from disclosure dealing with attorney-client privilege. The Public Records Act applies to all public agencies, including OUS. And what would happen in that situation if there's a public records request, then it would be reviewed by the attorney for whatever campus it comes from, and they'd make a determination whether or not it should be released or whether or not a privilege should be claimed. And then if the people or the organization requesting the public records request is unhappy with that, they go first to the district attorney, and then they can go to circuit court. The prevailing, if they prevail, they're entitled to recover attorney's fees. So this particular law, Senate Bill 220, will not affect the public records law. And the advice that is given would be given by the people hired by the system, the attorneys hired by the system initially, but if it went to litigation, then that advice would be offered by the Department of Justice.
Follow up, please. Then, in short, there wouldn't be any difference between what occurred in the Climas District and the same law would apply. And so the same liability would apply that the public might not be able to access those records.
Correct. The same law would apply. The advice might be different than the Klamath School District got, but the same law would apply because that's what the law of the state is right now.
Senator Pisanski.
Senator Bryant, I just want to follow up on that. It would be true, no matter who that attorney was, if they were in the Department of Justice, an assistant district, assistant attorney general, or one from the campus, the schools could still claim the exemption under the Public Records Act.
Correct.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor, I've got some questions, and it somewhat relates to this, because I think you've been getting legal advice on this issue of your living requirements in certain schools. And Chapter 659-400 deals with discrimination and public accommodation and housing. And your living campus, or your proposed 2005 fall living campus requirements, at least at Eastern, and I believe Southern and Western, are, in my opinion, extremely discriminatory. We're talking about adults. We're not talking about children. These are 18-year-old and older students for the most part. And you have a policy that says that if you are unmarried and under the age of 20, you have to live on campus. If you are an international student, you can live on campus, but you don't have to live on campus for more than 1 year. If you are a non-international student and non-married, you have to live on campus for 2 years. How is that not discrimination based on age, race, and marital status?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I don't know the answer to that. And the reason that I don't know the answer to that is I was
not familiar with those particular policies, but I will find out and I will get back to you. Part of the reason that some campuses do ask that particularly freshmen live on the campus is deals with the pedagogical as well as the orientation approach that that campus takes. But I'd have to look at Eastern, Southern, and Western and see what it is they were proposing and what their rationale was before I could respond to you intelligently.
Mr. Prinsteiner's lawyer is going to be testifying here pretty soon. You should ask him.
Maybe I should. This is an issue, and I appreciate this because I've had this conversation with the president in Eastern specifically, and he told me that he also gave me basically the same answer you just did, but the intent of the policy is for only first-year students, and I understand the issue of the policy of orientation and trying to bring people into from a family life into a college life and trying to do it without too much disruption. But we have struggled in this body to make college as affordable as possible, and we quite frankly, in the last 10 years, it's been very difficult. So you have a policy, at least on these three satellite campuses or smaller campuses, that seems to be trying to force students to live in the most expensive option there is. And it's also discriminatory. So I would appreciate a response from you and or from the Eastern program and the rest of these small. I'm most familiar with Eastern because it's under
fire. Tell us why.
Well, I have a dozen family members over at Eastern, but to
support that institution financially.
to adopt policies like this in midstream, because this is new for 2005. Prior to this, it was strictly a freshman only policy, which I understand the reasoning for that. I still think it's probably discriminatory, but when you start talking about 19 and 20 year olds, we're not talking about children, we're talking about adults. So I would appreciate a response back.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Unfortunately, I have to leave in 2 minutes for a meeting, so some people won't get to answer my probing questions, but I do have some probing questions for my next few minutes. Gentlemen, I don't care who answers this, but we have three state agencies that have independent status with Safe Corporation. We have OHSU, and we have the Oregon Lottery. Would you know if any of those use their own lawyers, or do they use the Department of Justice?
I believe they use the Department of Justice.
OHSU. OHSU uses their own.
Correct.
Okay. Do you know why OHSU gets to hire their own?
Because of the legislation that was passed in 1995.
Okay. I think that's a question that, Madam Chair, if I'm not back, if someone would ask the Attorney General. So what makes the Oregon University system feel it's different than the Lottery or Safe Corporation?
Because they currently turned off.
I'm dead. Oh, there we go. I'm dead. Yeah, I'm really dead. The Lottery and Safe use DOJ. So why do you think you should be different than those two agencies?
Well, Chair Bruce, Senator Walker, the case that we are making is one of client service, and I'm not trying to compare to other agencies. I'm merely trying to look at the situation in which we find ourselves, in which we have a double and triple review of the same thing, sometimes conflicting advice because of that. We're paying for all of that. But most importantly, we need to have someone on the campuses who understands the campus in order to help us in order to provide legal advice to help us properly manage and direct the affairs of the campuses. That's the main reason. And I'm not familiar with the other state agencies, and so I can't compare to them.
Madam Chair, my last question before I leave. I bet you are familiar with this opinion or this article, Mr. Bryant. I know that you have to be familiar with it because Mr. Frommeyer wrote it.
Oh.
And he's discussed it with you, and I'm sure the Attorney General is going to be discussing it with you, and I've made sure that all members of the committee got a copy of it because it's an article that Mr. Frommeyer, President Frommeyer, wrote in 1989, I believe, following an attempt by Safe Corporation to hire its own attorneys, and that Mr. Frohnmayer, President Frohnmayer, was Attorney General at that time and sued Safe Corporation for doing that. And he writes, this case was a dramatic and high-stakes test of the Attorney General's statutory control over litigation involving state agencies. And it's going to be interesting is to hear what's different now than it was in 1989, and unfortunately I'm going to have to listen to it on tape because I've got a meeting with Senator Brown, but what is different now? What can you tell me is different? I mean, there's a lot of good stuff that President Frohnmayer wrote in this article because he's a darn good lawyer, and it was well-reasoned. So how are things different today?
Well, we're fortunate today because he'll be able to answer that question, and I'm sure he anticipated it because when I first met with Attorney General Hardy Myers about this, he handed me that article and also some testimony that Dave had given in a case. The thesis that Dave Frohnmayer was working from was the benefit of having one law firm representing the entire state. And there is some benefit.
Why don't we break and let Mr. Frohnmayer? we all have this article and we're fascinated by it. So please identify yourself for the record. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, Dave Frohnmayer, President, University of Oregon, and in a former life has been identified Attorney General of the State of Oregon. The only reason I interrupt now is because Senator Walker has indicated her need to leave, and I believe there's a very direct, simple answer to the question. If I may, Madam Chair, Senator Walker, SAFE was attempting to sue the state of Oregon as an independent state agency. The State Board of Higher Education and universities are not asking for the right to sue the state of Oregon or the Attorney General. They're asking to be advised by attorneys of their own choosing for their own purposes. But the Dash 4 amendment you have before you explicitly in the case of private counsel would preclude any state agency with private counsel from suing the state of Oregon. We're not asking for that privilege. We don't come here with the audacity to suggest that we ought to have a case called state versus state, Oregon versus Oregon, which is really what the SAFE litigation was about in the 1980s. So this is really not the set of circumstances that's being asked for in terms of day-to-day advice that was involved in the article that I wrote and the words of which I still stand by.
I've just got to get this out, and I've got to go. President Frohnmayer, you say in the article, under the Oregon system, which is used as a model nationwide, accountability is maintained through many checks and balances. And then you talk about that in jurisdictions not using a consolidated system, the AG often is held accountable for the successes and more often the failures of legal services, despite the lack of control over them. So this isn't about necessarily SAFE suing the state. It's about the whole model that you believed in and that you created. And now you have a different reason to change the model. That's what I'm seeing.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, the model is an evolution because the nature of the characteristics of higher education have changed. And frankly, the simple and in some respects naive model of Chapter 180, I think, has been replaced by the realities of today's legislation in today's environment. Let me speak to that in two respects. First of all, as my colleagues have indicated, a university in today's society is very much like a small city. It has residential services. It has, in many cases, police services. It has food services. It generates electricity. It has telecommunications. It is a comprehensive entity, far different than Safe Corporation, for that matter, far different than the Oregon State Lottery, which are single-dimension entities. They're not comprehensive in terms of what you need on the scene, on the ground, in order to give effective advice, keep it out of trouble, and allow it to maximize its efficiency and its resources. So it's just plain different. If the University of Oregon were incorporated separately as a city, we would be Oregon's 20th largest city. If we were separately incorporated as a corporation, we would be among Oregon's 20 largest corporations. It's a very big, very complex entity, which calls for a different range and more variety of legal services.
Well, but wait a second, if I could interrupt, Mr. Frohnmayer. Universities have always been structured. They've always provided food service, and they've always had energy issues that you mentioned. They've always had medical services. They've always had police. What's different now than in 1991 when you wrote this article and you said that you argued for consolidation at that time? You said it would reduce costs, it would develop a clear, consistent legal policy, support good policy, accountability, quicker resolution of policy questions, all these that you listed as advantages for consolidation. But what is, you know, the form hasn't changed.
The legal environment has changed drastically, Senator Burdick. When I first came to the state of Oregon, and I came because the president of the university offered me, newly married, untenured assistant professor, a job as his legal counsel for the university. Not with the specific designation of the attorney general, although the attorney general approved the position. But at that time, that president, a very wise man who's now 95 years old, said, you know, there were only about three times a year that he would consult legal counsel. Maybe someone left a bequest to the university, and there was a contest between the heirs as to how much should go to the university, how much should go to them. Maybe there's a bond issue that required some interpretation. That's about it. Now there's not a single policy decision that I and my colleagues as president or the chancellor makes that is not enshrouded by a web of complexity of federal and state law. And that's because of the explosion in the last 30 years of United States Supreme Court decisions involving the interpretation and application of the Due Process Clause, the First Amendment of the United States Constitution primarily, and because of the explosion of federal and state litigation, legislation in areas of sex, race, age discrimination, in areas of control over finances. All of these things have changed the nature and complexity and frequency with which one needs to be in touch with legal counsel. So it changes that particular environment. And second, and I'm sorry that Senator Walker is not here to hear this response, but I hope it comes up on the tape and I will speak with her.
We'll anyway. Listen to it.
And that is that the nature of the disputes which bring us here are the regrettably lack of flexibility in our judgment of the Department of Justice in dealing with how those who are currently designated as Special Assistant Attorneys General can give their legal advice. Right now, routinely, and this has been true since my tenure as Attorney General, and it was actually to some degree true even before Special Assistant Attorneys General were officially designated by the Attorney General in higher education, that advice is routinely given to the Attorney General. It's screened by the Attorney General. It's part of the database of the Attorney General. And in the negotiations which so far have failed to reach agreement and which call for this legislation, therefore, we have agreed that it would be a good idea if the advice given on campus by the Special Assistant Attorneys General or these independent counsel employed by the university were in fact shared with the General Counsel Division of the Attorney General's Office, so there would be a database that's readily accessible, and so that, to the point that I made in that article of the 1980s, there's consistency in the state's legal position among agencies. So these are issues that can be accommodated. What has not been accommodated is this kind of rigid distinction between the Attorney General will give all your legal advice, but your policy advice remains with those who are charged with the administration of the system. The problem is that law and policy now are simply enmeshed in a web. And when I have a lawyer present, that lawyer may not be giving legal advice for 90% of her time, but the last 10% is very crucial. And frankly, none of us want the Attorney General's billable hours clock running for 50 minutes out of the hour when the issue really has to do with higher education policy, only to be really viable for the last 10 minutes when you need something, whether it's a letter written or advice given that's legal advice. So as a matter of efficiency, it is far better to have designations as Special Assistant Attorneys General to those whom we in the system believe are best qualified to be higher education administrators and policymakers, and to have what they can give when they have this designation, either by statute, which we're asking for here, or by the Attorney General's designation of Special Assistant Attorneys General, have the advice of counsel defense in the event that there's a lawsuit, and have, in those situations where it is justifiable, the attorney-client privilege, which allows candor of exchange in terms of your situation of litigation risk. So that's what's brought us here, is the relative degree of inflexibility that we have felt in our dealings with the department, So much so, if I may say, because this is a matter of public record, that we were instructed by the Attorney General several years ago that people in our employ could not use their legal credentials on their business cards. That is to say, they couldn't say that they had a JD degree, according to the Attorney General's interpretation of how far the sweep of Chapter 180, the Department of Justice Act, extends into our internal operations. That, it seems to me, is unduly rigid, authoritarian, goes beyond the interest of giving good, consistent legal advice, and into the area of trying to direct our personnel in the best ways that we believe they can be employed and deployed, and frankly, the most efficient and least expensive to the taxpayer.
Okay, let me propose a scenario, and I apologize for kind of probably coming in halfway through your testimony.
No, I came in halfway through everyone else's.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
If you had, let's say that you did have one of these lawyers that worked just for you, and they made they gave you some legal advice that put you at odds and perhaps to the detriment of your colleague from Oregon State University, how would that situation get resolved?
Well, we have no interest in having advice among the campuses that is inconsistent. The system itself has an interest in uniformity of advice and policy, and that's something we do under the present system, even with people who are not officially designated as Special Assistant Attorneys General.
Well, but right now you have, in the Attorney General's office, you have consistency, and in your article you said that you pointed out that you called them captive counsel at that time, and you said that they're identified with the interests of the specific agency instead of those of the state and the public. So you could have a counsel giving you advice that would be to the benefit of the University of Oregon, whereas if it were coming from a more centralized operation, they would be looking at the whole system. How do you get around that issue?
I don't think we need to get around it, because this statute addresses it directly. Instead of being a bootleg, unauthorized person who happens to have a law degree, the people appointed under this statutory change would be public attorneys, subject to the Professional Code of Ethics, which has very, very explicit provisions about the duties and obligations of a public attorney. And I have no doubt that those persons would faithfully make sure that they were as consistent as possible with the opinions of the Attorney General on these statewide subjects. And we don't have to go far for an example of where this is true. This is true of the United States government. The United States Attorney General is legal counsel for all of the state government, all of the federal government, and represents all federal agencies before the United States Supreme Court through the Solicitor General's office, and in most litigation, I may add. But each of the agencies has its separately appointed legal counsel, and those legal counsel for the Department of Education, the Solicitor General of the U.S. Department of Interior, they all look faithfully to the United States Attorney General's opinions. They all communicate faithfully with the United States Department of Justice. They are public attorneys charged with the public interest. So in that respect, this is employing a model of the appointment of authorized legal counsel that is not different from the United States government.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Maybe we'll excuse... Mr. Bryant, did you...
I had one other comment, too, Madam Chair. Frequently, state agencies and the university system institutions are criticized for not seeking change, just being same old, day after day. Well, this is responsive to that. I think the legislature wants the system to be more businesslike, to be more efficient, to get students through the system faster, to have answers to questions faster. And this legislation helps do that. And this is a collateral benefit, but we believe it'll save $1 million in the biennium, even though we're going to hire more SAGs that would be paid for by the universities. So some of the goals, especially the things we hear in the Ways and Means process, this is very responsive to that. Thank you.
Thank you. And you still would not use, because you were talking, Mr. Frohmeyer, about the restriction of having people not be able to even identify themselves as lawyers. You wouldn't take all the lawyers that you have working in the system who just happen to have law degrees and put them in legal capacities.
No. this legislation presumes that which is real for us, and that is that we are in a financial crisis in this state, and we don't intend to fill positions for more than they are needed. But we do think that it's more economical to have persons on our staff who are legally qualified and who have sufficient expertise to be able to utilize them rather than have to stop everything in mid-sentence or mid-meeting, make a phone call to Salem in order to get legal advice in this, as I say, kind of artificial distinction now between giving advice and making policy decisions. So we think that there are clear savings there. We are not promiscuously going to appoint persons as legal counsel, either beyond their capabilities, which gets us into our own legal trouble, or beyond our economical means to support them.
Thank you very much. We have Ed Ray signed up. So why don't you come in? Dave, why don't you stay there since you were supposed to be part of that panel? And I guess we can't get rid of you, huh?
No,
Neil?
Okay. I'm the centerpiece.
Welcome to the committee. You were very polite. You didn't come running up to the podium. Just kidding.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ed Ray, president of Oregon State University, and I'm happy to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 220. I don't want to repeat some of the conversation that you've already had. Let me try to be as brief as possible. The first observation that I'd make that really hasn't been made yet, I'm surprised, is that I actually understand the Attorney General's concern. I think there's been a good faith effort over the course of the last couple of years as instructed by the legislature for the Attorney General and for the university system to try to come to some accommodation about what are the needs on the campuses and how can that be satisfied under current law. My sense is it can't, and that's really why we're back here. That basically under current law, as I understand it, the Attorney General at the end of the day is responsible for the attorneys on campus, for the work they do, for the recommendations that they make, for who they are, whether they get hired and fired. And I think under the current law, there simply is not the flexibility that would be required for us to come to some kind of accommodation about the legal services that we need to meet our needs on campus. So then the question is, what are the needs we have on campus? And, you know, several people have asked, in what way is that special relative to other state agencies? I don't understand other state. I wouldn't even pretend to talk about other state agency needs. But I can tell you some things that are pretty unique about the universities. The universities, and I'll stay only with Oregon State University, about 20% or so of our operating budget comes from the state. If you add in the statewides, out of the $600 million that we operate with each year, about a third of all of our money comes from the state. Where does the other money come from? Well, the other money comes from tuition. You've heard that. But a large share of it comes from research, grants, and contracts. A large part of it comes from our normal business operations, our affiliated entities, our earnings units, whether it's housing and dining, so forth and so on. We are a large and complex organization. You've heard that said about universities before. But we, in order to operate, have to work not only with the state government and other state agencies, we have to work with the private sector, we have to work with state and federal agencies, and it's becoming more complicated all the time. We have to negotiate contracts, we have to be able to undertake business transactions, we're trying to do more with respect to technology transfer and licensing, we're trying to develop partnerships with businesses because we understand we have to grow our own resources. Bases. We're heavily involved in working with donors to bring in private support. That has many obvious legal aspects to it, how we set up the endowments and special funds that donors make available to us. We're trying at Oregon State University, we're talking about developing an innovation campus where we can do a lot more with respect to research grants and contracts. And again, to give you the sense of the dynamism, our research grants and contracts now at about almost $160 million a year grew by about $20 million last year. So we're not an agency that looks very static or that deals with very regular circumstances. We're an agency that has to deal with dramatic change all the time. Anytime you're in an organization that has to deal with constant change, probably the biggest challenge you have to deal with is how do you get policies and procedures right so that you don't ultimately end up in litigation. And this gets to this role of having the capacity to have our own in-house counsel. If we, in fact, have the people that we choose because we think they understand the context we work in, the people that we're able to train about the culture of the university and how we operate, if we can have them at the table whenever I need them there to talk about what do our policies with respect to, for example, tenure and promotion need to be, what do our policies need to be about writing memoranda of understanding with businesses that we hope to eventually have partnerships with, what do we need to do in terms of policies and procedures to set up an innovation campus. These are all areas of importance to us that require sound and sensible legal advice, not the kind that gets you into court and involved in litigation, but the kind that keeps you out of court and keeps you out of litigation. So I would submit to you that the ability to have our own in-house counsel to make sure we're able to pick those people because we believe they understand the culture, they can work well with the leadership team, they understand what we're trying to accomplish. I think we can save ourselves, and I think we can save the state a lot of money. I think the less we have to go to the Attorney General and ask for litigants to defend us in cases because we've dealt sensibly with policies and procedures up front, the less of a burden we're going to be to the Department of Justice as well. A final observation that I'd make about the value of in-house counsel, I mentioned how dynamic the situation is that we find ourselves in terms of trying to do business transactions, to develop partnerships, to explore new ways of getting work done. Obviously, if we have to take contracts to the Department of Justice and can't make decisions in-house about how to move forward with them, how to do risk assessments and so forth, that adds another layer of review, another time delay, another element of cost to any transactions that we hope to undertake. So I understand the concern of the Attorney General. I guess what I would say is I would argue free the Attorney General from the requirements of the current law, because under those requirements, we can't, as users of legal services, get the kind of advice and service that we need under the current circumstance. And to expect the Attorney General to figure out how to jimmy the system to meet our needs and stay compliant with the current law, I think is just not possible, and that's why Senate Bill 220 has been proposed, to give us that flexibility. Questions were raised about litigation. My expectation is I'm never going to court under the advice of my attorneys without consulting with the Department of Justice. We are a state agency. I expect the state to defend us as a state agency, and I expect any time a question comes up that could lead to litigation for my general counsel to be consulting with the Department of Justice about how do we best proceed on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from this committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we will hear from the other side of the story here, Mr. Attorney General Hardy Myers. And is there anyone you wanted to bring up with you? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Burdick and members, for the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I appreciate the opportunity to offer observations about Senate Bill 220. I have distributed to the committee a written statement of testimony along with a couple of exhibits. It is, for me, a fairly extensive statement. We've worked hard to take time to construct the analysis of the major concerns about the bill. I'm going to just try to be brief in summarizing those today, Madam Chair and members, with the hope that before the committee comes to a final decision on the issues raised by this bill, there'll be an opportunity for the committee to review that submitted material, either the committee members or their staffs, and perhaps an opportunity for me to converse with you further about it, again, before your final decision. Let me quickly identify the problem areas that are raised by the bill. It's, first of all, as you know, an authorization to hire, for the system to hire its own legal counsel. And therefore, it's an exception to a very long-standing statutory policy that those legal services are to be consolidated under the Attorney General. That's one component of the bill. The other components deal with an exemption of Oregon University System from any legal sufficiency review of its contracts. I believe, counsel, if I may, I believe they may have been mistaken in describing the scope of those provisions. They are an absolute exemption from all legal sufficiency review, mandatory legal sufficiency review, regardless of size or risk of transaction. So there are two very large policy changes embodied in this bill. And I've tried in my testimony to summarize at the outset some of the concerns those raise, and also to note that in response to the issue of the ability to have on-campus and immediately accessible attorney assistance, I have repeatedly offered to work with the system to locate assistant attorneys general on campus and work hard to provide economic terms for that form of assistance that would make it cost competitive, if you will, with attorneys that are directly employed by the Oregon University System. I have also offered what I consider a very generous interagency agreement that would authorize the system to employ additional special assistant attorneys general at each of the major universities and to provide some additional exemptions from legal sufficiency review. And I have attached as Exhibit A to my testimony, Madam Chair and members, the pending proposal from the Department of Justice, which is annotated to show proposals from the university system that I have declined to agree to, and a statement of the reasons why. In short, I have worked hard to try to arrive at an interagency-based accommodation to the needs of the system, alternative to stationing assistant attorneys general on campus, that would meet the on-campus legal advice needs of the system. I also want to stress that I've undertaken that effort, Madam Chair and members, in part because there has been a historical exception, if you will, to the general structure of legal services for the university system, for at least two of the three major campuses. For some, or at least four attorneys general's administrations, there have been special AAGs designated at the Eugene and Corvallis institutions and also in the chancellor's office. And this agreement expands that historical exception while still attempting to retain the reasonable kinds of controls that I think should attach to special assistant attorneys general if that label is not to become a complete fiction. And those reporting relationships are set forth in the proposed agreement. I hope the committee will take time to review the pending proposal from the Department of Justice, and the reasons given for rejecting certain proposals from the system. But certainly, I think that the proposed agreement meets the on-campus legal needs of the Oregon University System, at least at this time. So the first component of concerns that I've tried to analyze in my testimony center around Chapter 180 and the complete exemption alternative to the SAG arrangements of the universities from the control of legal advice by the Attorney General, except to the extent the dash, what numbers were they, the two sets of amendments provide, dash 3, dash 4. Like my predecessors, I have opposed attempts to undercut Chapter 180. 6 years ago, Safe Corporation proposed legislation that would have allowed it to hire its own outside counsel. I opposed that legislation, and the 99 Assembly rejected it. And by the way, the reason why Oregon Health Sciences University has its own cadre of lawyers is that it's no longer a state agency. It's no longer a state agency. And during the 2003 session, as I believe Mr. Bryant mentioned, the system proposed as part of Senate Bill 437 proposals that essentially duplicate those in Senate Bill 220. And again, as was mentioned, Senator Starr's Senate Education Committee had that bill. And from the consideration of that part of Senate Bill 437 arose, the legislature did not approve those provisions. Instead, there arose an interagency agreement between then-Chancellor Jarvis and myself with respect to legal assistance bearing on OSU business transactions. I've attached that as Exhibit B to my testimony because I think it exemplifies the willingness of the Department of Justice to attempt to respond to issues around legal service and to attempt to provide those services as efficiently and cost-effectively as possible. It's a fairly detailed agreement. Time periods for action by the department, for one thing. And from my perspective, I think the agreement functioned quite well. The system did not renew it after its one-year expiration date occurred, but the university, pardon me, but the Department of Justice has continued to adhere to the provisions of the agreement in its processing of business transactions. As I noted in my testimony also, Chapter 180 rests, and the control there, according to the Attorney General over legal advice, rests on the values ascribed by the legislature to a single state legal policy. The ability to control, to develop a clear and consistent policy, clearer lines of responsibility and accountability. I think it reflects concerns about taking care to be mindful of issues around in-house counsel as the form of legal advice being rendered in terms of particularly the independence of that advice. There may be issues of whether, that's certainly a principal concern. And there's a fair amount of writing about the issue of the in-house model of providing counsel to organizations, public and private. I've also in my testimony noted some additional concerns that are summarized and that I won't go into detail now, but I would, as I say, hope that the committee members will have the opportunity to review that testimony in detail before you consider the matter further. Quick comment on the federal model issue before I talk very briefly about legal sufficiency review, Madam Chair. It's been suggested to me, and I think it was by President Lawrenson of the State Board of Higher Education, that the federal model for the delivery of legal services to government, where agencies hire their own general counsel and the Attorney General handles the litigation, is the desirable model. Actually, under the federal model, the U.S. Department of Justice, I think, exercises a much greater degree of control over litigation than actually the Attorney General may, even with these amendments in Oregon. But the federal system, I think it should be noted, is not a universally respected model. And I've cited in my testimony a very thoughtful article by former Attorney General Griffin Bell in the Foreign Law Review, which criticized that arrangement which this bill would in effect bring into being for the Oregon University system. And interestingly, Madam Chair and members, in the Griffin Bell article, there's a quotation from an 1870 floor statement by a member of the United States Senate on the occasion in 1870 of an attempt in Congress to bring the legal advice, the lawyers of the federal government under the United States, under the Attorney General. And Senator Jenks of Rhode Island, as I've noted in my testimony, said on the floor of the Senate, in respect to the situation that then existed and still exists in the federal government, we have found that there has been a most unfortunate result from the separation of law powers. We find one interpretation of the laws of the United States in one department and another interpretation in another department. So it's, and he goes on to say, it's for the purpose of having a unity of decision, a unity of jurisprudence in the executive law of the United States that this bill, that is the one in Congress, proposes that all law officers therein provided for shall be subordinate to one head. And of course, also, Oregon is not federal government in the sense of having tens of thousands of lawyers employed by the government. We have about 250. So the practicality of attempting to exert some measure of coordination and control is far more realistic in our governmental setting. Finally, Madam Chair, members, I have devoted a portion of my testimony to reviewing the concerns raised by the complete exemption of the university system from all mandatory legal sufficiency review.
Could you just describe to the committee what a legal sufficiency review is?
Yes, and I've noted that in my testimony. It really involves answering two basic questions. Is the contract legal? And secondly, does the contract accomplish the agency's desired result in terms of an enforceable statement of work? Those are the two key inquiries. And in 1997, the current regime of legal sufficiency review, with authority in the Attorney General to grant exceptions from that review, and that authority has been exercised several times by my office since then, that whole regime of control arose from what I have heard one member of the legislature refer to aptly as a number of exploding cigars. There were multiple very expensive public contract fiascos, such as computer system failures and other contract imbroglios that involved a great deal of money. Under the prior law, or absence of law, agencies could sign multi-million dollar contracts with no legal review. Agencies could ask for legal review of a contract, but then be free to disregard the legal advice. Agencies did not need to seek any legal input at the request for proposal or invitation to bid stage, and those are major features of the legal landscape prior to the law enacted in 1997. And we think there have been significant values for the state by the legislature's decision to enact that control structure in 1997. I've tried to summarize those in my testimony as well. Now let's bear in mind that the university system, I think, and I have members of the department who are much more familiar in great detail than I am about the nature of some of their transactions, but I think some of them are among the more complex in state government. And this is a $4.2 billion all funds operation, this portion of state government. So we're dealing here with a very large part of the total activities of state government, and I think it's to be expectable that there will be complex transactions arising. We have worked very diligently since the inception of the 97 contract regime to create exemptions when we felt it was responsible to do so. And we have requested the university system and other agencies to work with us in helping to identify still further exemptions. And the basic proposal that we've submitted to the university system for our interagency agreement, insofar as legal review is concerned, is it does expand exemptions to some extent, but insofar as the review of what I would just generally call more complex transactions, it proposes to treat the special assistant attorneys general just as we treat the other assistant attorneys general of the Department of Justice. If we believe that a special assistant attorney general has the competence to deal with a particular kind of transaction, legal review authority will be permitted. If not, then we expect that transaction will be reviewed by the business transaction section of the department. And that same restriction applies to all assistant attorneys general at this time, not just to SACs. Final comment, Madam Chair and members, before closing, and that is on the cost issue. Now, I had reference to a legislative fiscal office analysis, which I quite candidly have not yet seen, Madam Chair. But I think it's important for the committee to bear in mind that SAG positions, that is to say, the form of SAG that is employed by within the university system, is not an inexpensive kind of position. It's very expensive. And I'd be prepared to predict for the committee that if we took the projected effects of the interagency agreement we have presently proposed and take into account the additional costs to the system of the SAG positions, the further SAG positions that are authorized in this agreement, I'd be willing to predict to the committee that you'd find very little actual cost saving to the system. And I'd very much like to have a chance to work with the system and perhaps with legislative fiscal to see if we could generate for you what we could view as a essentially consensus analysis of that cost before the committee decides that it wants to make some decision based on perceived cost savings. A reference in the cost context to multiple reviews of documents, now that simply should not happen. If we have clear understandings between the university system and the Department of Justice as to which kinds of agreements are authorized to be reviewed by SAGs and which will come to the business transaction sections, there shouldn't be any multiple layer of lawyering. And the Department of Justice should be able to deal directly with the appropriate contracting officials of the given institution. There's one layer of lawyer. One layer of lawyer. So, Madam Chair and members, for the foregoing reasons, I very respectfully urge you to reject Senate Bill 220. It is not my intention not to try to be nimble and flexible in dealing with the legitimate needs of the system. I think the proposed interagency agreement, especially as it relates to on-campus legal advice needs of the major institutions, does that. But I would welcome the committee's taking the time to actually review the pending draft of the proposed agreement, our analysis of certain other proposals from the institutions that we have declined to agree to, and the reasons for that, and make your own judgments about whether, in relation to the issues that have been raised today, this interagency agreement doesn't appropriately address those. I'm representing to you my view that they do. I certainly am open to continuing dialogue with the system to seek an interagency resolution of the concerns raised, but I genuinely think the pending proposal is one that is a very, very responsible effort on the part of my office to respond to the issues they've raised. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. I heard you say that you're willing to have SAGs, Special Attorney Generals, Attorneys General, located on each of the three major campuses, University of Oregon, Oregon State, and Portland State, that you're willing to have Assistant Attorneys General actually locate on the campuses to meet the need of day-to-day operations. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's what the interagency agreement in part proposes.
And then I also heard you say that your problem is with the exemption from all legal sufficiency review, but you're willing to discuss exemptions for some types of transactions that don't meet certain size or risk criteria. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, there are provisions in the proposed agreement that actually widen the existing or would widen the existing scope of exemptions that apply to some transactions that the university system is involved in. The rub, I think, is the question, again, as I mentioned earlier, of under what circumstances, what's the scope of the authority of SAGs to conduct legal sufficiency review of contracts. And we're proposing that the SAGs would be required to follow the same allocation of work policies that we apply to assistant attorneys general in terms of whether the particular lawyer is authorized to review a transaction for legal sufficiency because the qualifications of that attorney match the, as we judge it, the requirements for that review, or whether that transaction is going to have to go to our business transactions section. We're proposing exactly the same allocation for the SAGs versus Department of Justice as we do for our own assistant attorneys general who are outside the business transactions section versus the business transactions section.
Okay, so the people in your business transactions section have special training. How extensive is that training, and would that training be available to SAGs? Because that seems to be an area of major contention here.
Madam Chair, most of the members of the business transactions section have become, by virtue of some measure of special training and their just ongoing accumulated experience, specialists in one of, I think we divide into four basic areas of contracts. Our policy dealing with work allocation, if I recall correctly, I believe it's that policy, it does address training requirements. Training experience requirements that apply to the qualification of an attorney to review certain kinds of matters. And I can provide that work allocation policy to the committee if you'd like, Madam Chair, policies that would bear on that work allocation issue.
That would be helpful. I'd be interested. Senator Krasanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a number of questions, and that's all right.
That's fine.
Hardy, I'm listening to testimony. I've heard from both sides at different times, and I guess I'm going to just throw out some questions. I guess from my perspective of what we've been asked as a legislature over the years, we're asking different agencies, specifically in the university system, to basically run the universities as a business. And I take that in the concept as to what does that mean. I also took the notice to what our funding level to universities are, and it may be that as much as I hate to even jest in saying this, that our public universities, we don't fund them at the level that they should be funded at. Maybe they will be spun off and be private, and they won't be part of the system, and that would maybe be different as we've seen in with OHSU. But I know that there's already SAGs on campus. I know at least one of the individuals I've worked with and have met and been in different forums with. And I ask you, is there, in the experience that you've had in Attorney General or any of the experiences you've heard from other attorneys that have been there longer than you have, has the work product of these individuals been less than satisfactory?
Madam Chair, Senator Krasanski, I don't know that insofar as the SAGs are concerned, I could give you any number of examples of where we might think the work was deficient. For one thing, we don't know a lot about what specifically the SAGs are doing with respect to their specific institutions. I don't think it's factually accurate to say, as I believe one of the earlier witnesses said, that we get a lot of regular reporting flow from the SAGs. And indeed, President Frommeyer, if I didn't misunderstand him, was describing what sounded like a kind of a reporting relationship, at least as it applies to SAGs, that is really the relationship we're proposing in the interagency agreement. That is to say, because the legal advice given by SAGs can be important in other contexts, ultimately, we'd like to be informed what the final legal advice is that the SAGs are rendering on matters they're concerned. So the issue, Madam Chair, Senator Krasanski, I don't think that aside from the issue of the review for legal sufficiency of transactions, the pushback that I've presently had to the use of SAGs
I don't think it's really quality related. And certainly I have a high regard for the individuals who have performed in those roles to this point.
It's my understanding that some of these individuals have a number of years of higher ed experience in providing legal services. And so I'd ask, do you know of any lawsuits or any claims that have been filed based on inappropriate or wrong legal advice that has been given by the current SAGs that are working with the universities?
Chair Burdick, Senator Brzezinski, I do not. I could check on that to be sure I'm being factual. I'm not instantly aware of any.
And under this scenario, without going to, and we have not, thank you for your testimony as to, and the proposal, I have not seen it until today, so we'll have to go through that. But do you know as to who would make the decision as to the needs of the campus, of the institution itself, as to when a SAG should be appointed under the current system as compared to allowing the campuses to determine their need based on their workload or what they anticipate through their budgeting process?
Chair Burdick, Senator Brzezinski, insofar as the bill is concerned, of course, that authority goes completely to the institutions. And by the way, interestingly, it's authority that goes to the presidents of each institution, to the board, to the chancellor. So there are multiple locations of authority. Insofar as the interagency agreement is concerned, the agreement would establish two special assistant attorneys general at each of the three major institutions. And the attorney general, under this agreement, would give, I'm looking for the exact wording, but would give careful consideration to requests for additional SAGs at any one or more of those institutions. We have a disagreement on that point. The system has proposed that the Attorney General shall create additional SAGs if an institution or the system requests it. And I think that is a subtraction of some basic authority of the Attorney General in relation to SAGs, Special Assistant Attorneys General, that's not appropriate.
All right. Hardy, I guess when I look at this and understand there's a proposal here, I kind of take it and put it to the side because, to me, I'm looking at the Senate Bill 220. I mean, this is an alternative, and unless we're going to actually legislate that the campuses enter into this type of agreement or we make this the new SB 220 through some type of amendment process, I'm trying to figure out what the connect or disconnect is in the current part. And I understand you're concerned about protecting and preserving what has been historically in the 180 chapter. But it also, I understand the need to be able to have decisions made on a very timely basis. And one of my concerns is that when they have multiple ways to have to actually engage people, bring them in, bring them up to speed, and then have those questions answered, that takes time. Of course, it takes money on funding budgets, but the turnaround time is one of the concerns I have, understanding that in any large corporation, you need to have someone there that can answer, make these decisions. And it seems to me that there can be, if there needs to be maybe some additional safeguards that what maybe 220 has in there. But at the same time, it just seems like we're asking, in this case, the institutions of higher ed to stay within a confine with much more restricted approaches of how they can conduct their business on a day-to-day basis, and that we may actually lose out on opportunities and when it comes to research grants, research money, contracting with other this corporations or businesses that want to engage the services with the university. And so I question about the turnaround time, and I guess the last thing I'll ask you is, under the current program, the SAG's final authority is to who? To either you as the Attorney General or to the campuses?
Chair Burdick, Senator Brzezinski, first, as to the question of concern about promptness or turnaround time, focus on that for a moment. First of all, I think that the interagency agreement would provide the major institutions with on-campus capabilities to deal with a variety, wide range of issues that SAGs currently deal with. And, of course, the timing of those is obviously in a matter under the direct control of the particular president and the Senate. To the extent that in the setting of the interagency agreement, the Department of Justice would be involved in addressing the matter, and we'd be, I think, in the context of the issue of turnaround time, Senator Prostansky, you're primarily going to be talking about business transactions type of situations. You're talking about grants, lost opportunities, whatever. It's a fairly easy and straightforward matter for the system and the Department of Justice to enter into express protocols with respect to the timing of work. I invite your consideration of the agreement from 2003 dealing with business transactions, a lot of which was focused on the issue of timing of completion of work. And as I said, from our perspective, Senator Prostansky, I thought that agreement worked quite well. We're still adhering to it in terms of many timelines that are applicable to work involving business transactions for the Oregon University system. So I think it's, in sum, I think so far as promptness of work that the Department of Justice handles under any regime of agreement, it's fairly straightforward and easy to arrive, assuming it's otherwise exempt from, say, legal sufficiency review, it's easy enough to arrive at a good working protocol that we adhere to. We have adhered to the one that I mentioned in 2003.
The last question regarding ultimate power and authority over the SAGs, is it with you or is it with the campuses?
Chair Burdick, Senator Prostansky, I think so long as the position is a special assistant attorney general, the current statutory values of the legislature would vest ultimate authority with the attorney general.
Thank you.
So but may I add, Madam Chair?
Hiring and firing authority over these people.
That would be, if I recall correctly, the interagency agreement requires the approval of the Attorney General to hire a particular SAG. But termination of a SAG would be, I think, a decision of the institution.
That's interesting. We'll have to take a look at that. Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Walker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, and because I was gone, I don't know if the question got asked.
It did.
About OHSU.
It's not a state agency.
Okay. Yeah, it got separated in 95 or 85 or some darn
That's
thing.
That's where it happened.
Okay. Great. All right. I'll ask.
So now you don't have to listen to the tape.
Yeah. I know. I've got so many of them in my car now. So
thank you. Are there other
thank
questions?
You.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 220, and I'm going to reopen it in a few minutes for the purposes of allowing George Franzen, who said he came from over 100 miles, to testify. But before I lose my quorum, I want to take up a quick work session on Senate Bill 106. We're now in work session on Senate Bill 106, Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 106 was heard for a public hearing on February 21st. This is the measure that make several amendments to the elder abuse and abuse of individuals who are disabled statutes. The amendments focus on four areas. First, the dash, and they're all in a dash one amendment that should be in your packet. The dash one modifies the definition of a disabled person to narrow that, to clarify that it excludes considerations regarding Social Security eligibility that are irrelevant for purposes of definition under this statute. The dash one also modifies the definition of abuse with respect to threatening or wrongfully taking, with regards to threatening to wrongfully take or appropriate money in a way that focuses on the effect of the threat. The purpose of the change here was to make sure that the measure complies with Article 1, Section 8. And finally, the dash one narrows the catch-all relief provision of the restraining order section of the measure. And in this respect, the original version of the bill was very broad. It permitted the court to issue any relief it found appropriate. And here in the amendment, the court needs to would be required to actually
be limited in its catch-all provision. There's still quite a bit of flexibility. The court will be permitted to direct the respondent to refrain from exercising control over the petitioner's property, to require the return of the petitioner's property, to require the respondent to follow the instructions were created for a previously appointed guardian or conservator, or prohibit the respondent from transferring the petitioner's money to anyone but the petitioner. This was a result of an ad hoc work group comprising of Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard, Aaron Kelly Seal, the Governor's Office, Alyssa Seidlick of the Oregon Judicial Department, and myself.
Thank you for that brief summary, Counsel. Senator Starr, have you seen the Dash 1 amendments? Do you have a motion?
Chair Burdick, I move the Dash 1 amendments,
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 106. Is there any discussion, any objections? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 106 as amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 106 as amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, any objections? So ordered. Let's see. Senator Starr, would you like to carry this?
Yes.
Please do. Thank you. We will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 220. You guys stop. For the purposes of quorum here, we will move the rest of the agenda today, everything that has not been taken up, to tomorrow's agenda. So ordered. Bye. We will now reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 220 for purposes of hearing from George Franson, who has come from 100 miles away. Mr. Franson does not appear to be in the audience. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 220. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.